with Nancy firmly occupied somewhere else, another possibility sprang to mind. When I saw Alice for coffee that afternoon, I asked if she'd like to come. The warmth of her reply helped me through the evenings of the week, and we talked about it every day. The plan was that I'd ring home early evening, when Nancy was back from a day, and say that I'd run into someone up there and wouldn't be back until late. It was a bending of our unspoken doing-things-by-the-book rule, but it had to be done. Alice and I needed a longer period with each other, and I needed to build myself up to what had to be done. By mid-evening on Friday, I was at fever pitch. I was pacing round the house, not settling at anything, so much in my own little world that it took me a while to notice that something was up with Nancy, too. She was sitting in the living room, going over some papers, but kept glancing angrily out the window as if expecting to see someone. When I asked her about it, slightly irritably, she denied she was doing it, and then 10 minutes later I saw her do it again. I retreated to the kitchen and did something dull to a shelf that I'd been putting off for months. When Nancy stalked in to make some more coffee, she saw what I was doing and seemed genuinely touched that I'd finally gotten around to it. My smile of self-deprecating good-naturedness felt as if it was stretched across the lips of a corpse. Then she was back out in the lounge again, glaring nervously out the window, as if fearing imminent invasion from a Martian army. It reminded me of the night I'd seen her standing by the window, which I had found rather spooky. She was looking very flaky that evening, and I'd run out of pity. I simply found it irritating, and hated myself for that. Eventually, finally, at long last, it was time for bed. Nancy went ahead and I volunteered to close windows and tidy ashtrays. It's funny how you seem most solicitous and endearing when you don't want to be there at all. What I actually wanted was a few moments to wrap a present I was going to give to Alice. When I heard the bathroom door shut, I leaped for the filing cabinet and took out the book. I grabbed tape and paper from a drawer and started wrapping. As I folded, I glanced out of the window and saw the cat sitting outside in the road and smiled to myself. With Alice, I'd be able to have a cat of my own, could work with furry company and doze with a warm bundle on my lap. The bathroom door opened again and I paused, ready for instant action. When Nancy's feet had padded safely into the bedroom, I continued wrapping. When it was done, I slipped the present in a drawer and took out the card I was going to give with it, already composing in my head the message from the inside.
Mark?
I nearly died when I heard Nancy's voice. She was striding through the kitchen toward me, and the card was still lying on my desk. I quickly drew a sheaf of papers toward me and covered it, but only just in time. Heart beating horribly, feeling almost dizzy, I turned to look at her, trying to haul an expression of bland normality across my face.
What's this?
She demanded, holding her hand up in front of me. It was dark in the room and I couldn't see at first. Then I saw. It was a hair, a dark brown hair. It looks like a hair, I said carefully, shuffling papers on the desk.
I know what it fucking is,
she snapped.
It was in the bed. I wonder how it got there.
Jesus Christ, I thought. She knows. I stared at her with my mouth clamped shut and wavered on the edge of telling the truth, of getting it over with. I thought it would happen some other calmer way, but you never know. Perhaps this was the pause into which I had to drop the information that I was in love with someone else. Then, belatedly, I realized that Alice had never been in the bedroom. Even since the night of the canal, she'd only ever been in the living room and the downstairs hall. Maybe the kitchen, but certainly not the bedroom. I blinked at Nancy, confused.
It's that bloody cat,
she shouted, instantly livid in the way that always disarmed and frightened me.
It's been on our fucking bed.
What cat?
The cat who's always fucking outside, your little friend.
She sneered violently, face almost unrecognizable.
You've had it in here.
I haven't. What are you talking about?
Don't you deny, don't you?
Unable to finish, Nancy simply threw herself at me and smashed me across the face. Shocked, I stumbled backward and she whacked me across the chin, and then pummeled her fists against my chest as I struggled to grab hold of her hands. She was trying to say something, but it kept breaking up into furious sobs. In the end, before I could catch her hands, she took a step backward and stood very still. She stared at me for a moment, and then turned and walked quickly out of the room. I spent the night on the sofa, and was awake long after the last long moaning sound had floated out to me from the bedroom. It may sound like selfish evasion, but I really felt I couldn't go to comfort her. The only way I could make her feel better was by lying, so in the end I stayed away. I had plenty of time to finish writing the card to Alice, but found it difficult to remember exactly what I'd been going to say. In the end, I struggled into a shallow, crap sleep, and when I woke, Nancy was already gone for the day. I felt tired and hollow as I drove to meet Alice in the center of town. I still didn't actually know where she lived, or even her phone number. She hadn't volunteered the information, and I could always contact her via the courier firm. I was content with that until I could enter her life without any skulking around. I remember very clearly the way she looked, standing on the pavement and watching out for my car. She was wearing a long black woolen skirt and a thick sweater of various chestnut colors. Her hair was backlit by morning light, and when she smiled as I pulled over toward her, I had a moment of plunging doubt. I don't have any right to be with her, I thought. I already have someone, and Alice is far and away too wonderful. But she put her arms around me and kissed my nose, and the feeling went away. I have never driven so slowly on a motorway as that morning with Alice. I put some tapes in the car, music I knew we both liked, but they never made it out of the glove compartment. They simply weren't necessary. I sat in the slow lane and poodled along at 60 miles an hour. Then we talked to a set in silence, sometimes glancing across at each other and grinning. The road cuts through several hills, and when we reached the first cutting, we both gasped at once. The embankment was a blaze of poppies, nodding in a gathering wind. And when we left them behind, I turned to Alice and for the first time said I loved her. She stared at me for a long time, and in the end I had to glance away at the road. When I looked back, she was looking straight ahead and smiling, her eyes shining with held-back tears. My meeting took just under 15 minutes. I think my client was rather taken aback, but who cares? We spent the rest of the day walking around the shops, picking up books and looking at them, stopping for 2 cups of tea. As we came laughing out of a record store, she slung her arm around my back, and very conscious of what I was doing, I put mine around her shoulders. Though she was tall, it felt comfortable, and there it stayed. By about 5, I was getting tense, and we pulled into another cafe to have more tea and so I could make my phone call. I left Alice sitting at the table waiting to order, and went to the other side of the restaurant to use the booth. As I listened to the phone ringing, I willed myself to be calm and turned my back on the room to concentrate on what I was saying.
Hello.
When Nancy answered, I barely recognized her. Her voice was like that of a querulously frightened old woman who'd not been expecting a call. I nearly put the phone down, but she realized who it was and immediately started crying. It took me about 20 minutes to calm her even a little. She'd left the team building at lunchtime claiming illness. Then she'd gone to Sainsbury's. She had eaten 2 Sara Lee chocolate cakes, a fudge roll, a packet of cereal, and 3 packets of biscuits. She'd gone to the bathroom, vomited, and then started again. I think she'd been sick again at least once, but I couldn't really make sense of part of what she said. It was so mixed up with abject apologies to me that the sentences became confused, and I couldn't tell whether she was talking about the night before or about the half-eaten packet of Jell-O she still had in her hand. Feeling a little frightened and completely unaware of anything outside the cubicle I was standing in, I did what I could to focus her until what she was saying made a little more sense. I gave up trying to say that no apology was needed for last night, and in the end just told her everything was all right. She promised to stop eating for a while, and to watch television instead. I said I'd be back as soon as I could. I had to. I loved her. There was nothing else I could do. When the last of my change was gone, I told her to take care and slowly replace the handset. I stared at the wood paneling in front of me and gradually became aware of the noise from the restaurant on the other side of the glass door behind me. Eventually, I turned and looked out. Alice was sitting at the table, watching the passing throng. She looked beautiful and strong, and about 2,000 miles away. We drove back to London in silence. Most of the talking was done in the restaurant. It didn't take very long. I said I couldn't leave Nancy in the state that she was in, and Alice nodded once tightly and put her cigarettes in a bag. She said that she'd sort of known, perhaps even before we'd got to Cambridge. I got angry then and said she couldn't have done, because I hadn't known myself. She got angry back when I said we'd still be friends, and she was in the right, I suppose. It was a stupid thing for me to say. Awkwardly, I asked if she'd be all right, and she said yes, in the sense that she'd survive. I tried to explain that was a difference, that Nancy might not be able to. She struggled and said that was the other difference. Nancy would never have to find out if she could. The more we talked, the more my head felt it was going to explode. The more my eyes felt as if they could burst with the pain and run in bloody lines down my cold cheeks. In the end, she grew businesslike and paid the bill, and we walked slowly back to the car. Neither of us could bring ourselves to small talk in the car, and for the most part, the only sound was that of the wheels upon the road. It was dark by then, and rain began to fall before we'd been on the motorway for very long. When we passed through the first cut in the hillside, I felt the poppies all around us, heads battered down by the falling water. Alice turned to me.
I did know.
How? I said, trying not to cry, trying to watch what the cars behind me were doing.
When you said you loved me, you sounded so unhappy.
I dropped her in town, on the corner where I'd picked her up. She said a few things to help me, to make me feel less bad about what I'd done. Then she walked off around the corner, and I never saw her again. When I'd parked outside the house, I sat for a moment, trying to pull myself together. Nancy would need to see me looking whole and at her disposal. I got out and locked the door, looking around half-heartedly for the cat. It wasn't there. Nancy opened the door with a shy smile, and I followed her into the kitchen. As I hugged her and told her everything was all right, I gazed blankly over her shoulder around the room. The kitchen was immaculate, no sign left of the afternoon's festivities. The rubbish had been taken out, and something was bubbling on the stove. She cooked me dinner. She didn't eat, but sat at the table with me. The chicken was okay, but not up to her usual standard. There was a lot of meat, but it was tough, and for once there was a little too much spice. It tasted odd, to be honest. She noticed a look on my face, and said she'd gone to a different butcher. We talked a little about her afternoon, but she was feeling much better. She seemed more interested in discussing the way her office reorganization was shaping up. Afterward, she went through into the lounge and turned the television on, and I set about making coffee and washing up, moving woodenly around the kitchen as if on abandoned rails. As Nancy's favorite inanity boomed out from the living room, I looked around for a bin bag to shovel the remains of my dinner into, but she'd obviously used them all. Sighing with a complete lack of feeling, I opened the back door and went downstairs to put it directly into the bin. There were two sacks by the bin, both tied with Nancy's distinctive knot. I undid the nearest and opened it a little. Then, just before I pushed the bones off my plate, something in the bag caught my eye. A patch of darkness amid the garish wrappers of high-calorie comfort foods. An oddly shaped piece of thick fabric, perhaps. I pulled the edge of the bag back a little farther to look, and the light from the kitchen window above fell across the contents of the bag. The darkness changed to a rich chestnut brown flecked with red, and I saw it wasn't fabric at all. We moved 6 months later, after we got engaged. I was glad to move. The flat never felt like home again. Sometimes I go back and stand in that street, remembering the weeks in which I stared out of the window, pointlessly watching the road. I called the courier firm after a couple of days. I was expecting a stonewall, and knew it was unlikely they'd give an address. But they denied she'd ever worked there at all. After a couple of years, Nancy and I had our first child, and she'll be 8 this November. She has a sister now. Some evenings I'll leave them with their mother and go out for a walk. I'll walk with heavy calm through black streets beneath featureless houses, and sometimes go down to the canal. I sit on the bench and close my eyes, and sometimes I think I can see it. Sometimes I think I can feel the way it was, when a hill was there and meetings were held in secret. In the end, I always stand up slowly and walk the streets back to the house. The hill is gone, and things have changed, and it's not like that anymore. No matter how long I sit and wait, the cats will never come. Catch. Ray Vukcevich.
Ray Vukcevich's fiction has appeared in many magazines, including the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, Smoke Long Quarterly, Night Train, Polyphony, and Hobart, and has been collected in Meet Me in the Moon Room. He also works as a programmer in a couple of brain labs at the University of Oregon. Read more about him at www.sff.net/people/RAYV. I asked the author how he came up with the preposterous germ of his story, and this is what he relates. The story, I remember, came from a jumble of images. I remembered throwing my son up in the air when he was a baby. He loved it. Those might have been his first giggles. But one time, I nearly missed. It was a close call. He was so slippery for some reason, and I might have dropped him. He might have hit his head on the edge of the coffee table on the way down. It might have been a disaster. My wife was sitting across the room reading, smiling up at us now and then. She didn't realize what had happened, and I didn't tell her, and now it's too late. But the kid seemed to know, or maybe it was the look on my face. He clutched at my shirt. I hugged him in close rather than go for one more toss. Oddly, the other image was of a kitten who had put her paw through a hole in a cardboard box to swat at the turtle inside, and the turtle had grabbed the paw. Much drama. Once I got the cat loose, I tossed her to my wife, who caught her neatly. The story didn't come together for more than 20 years after those two incidents.
"Your face," I say, "is a wild animal this morning, Lucy, and I'm glad it's caged. Her scowl is so deep I can't imagine she's ever been without it. Her yellow hair is a frumpy halo around her wire mask. My remark doesn't amuse her. I know what I did. I just don't know why it pissed her off. And if I don't know, insensitive bastard that I am, she certainly isn't going to tell me. She lifts the cat over her head and hurls it at me. Hurls it hard. I catch it and underhand it back to her. The cat is gray on top and snowy white below and mostly limp. Its eyes rolled back in its head and its coated tongue hanging loose out of one side of its mouth. I know from experience that it will die soon. And its alarm collar will go off, and one of us will toss it into the ditch that runs between us. A fresh angry bundle of teeth and claws will drop from the hatch in the ceiling. And we'll toss the new cat back and forth between us until our staggered breaks and someone takes our places. The idea is to keep the animals in motion 24 hours a day. In this profession, we wear canvas shirts and gloves and wire cages on our faces. I sometimes dream we've lost our jobs, Lucy and me. What a nightmare. What else do we know? My replacement comes in behind me. He takes up the straw broom and dips it into the water in the ditch that runs through the toss box and sweeps at the smeared feces and urine staining the floors and walls. A moment later, the buzzer sounds, and he puts the broom back in the corner. I step aside, and Lucy tosses the cat to him. I slip out of the box and into the catacomb for my 15-minute break before moving on to the next box. Lucy and I work an hour on and 15 minutes off all day long. As we move from toss box to toss box, our paths cross and recross. I'll be out of phase with her for half an hour, probably just long enough for her to work up a real rage. The catacomb is a labyrinth of wide tunnels dotted with concrete boxes. There is a metal chute running from the roof to the top of each box. The boxes are evenly spaced, and there is a light bulb for every box, but not all the bulbs are alive, so there are gaps in the harsh light. The boxes are small rooms, and there is a wooden door on each side so catchers can be replaced without interrupting the tossing. The concrete walls of the tunnels, like the concrete walls of the boxes, are streaked black and white and beaded with moisture. The floors are roughened concrete. Everything smells like wet rocks and dead things. So what did I do? While Lucy dressed for work this morning, I played with our infant daughter, Megan, tossing her into the air and catching her again, blowing bubbles into her stomach while she pulled my hair and giggled until she got the hiccups. When Lucy came in, I tossed the baby in a high arc across the room to her. Megan tumbled in a perfect backward somersault in the air. Lucy went dead white. She snatched Megan out of the air and hugged the child to her chest. "Nice catch," I said.
"Don't you ever,"
Lucy said, her voice all husky and dangerous.
"Ever do that again, Desmond. Not ever."
Then she stomped out, taking Megan with her. What the hell? I'd known there was no chance whatever that Lucy would miss. She's a professional. My trusting her to catch the love of my life, the apple of my eye, Daddy's little girl, was, I thought, a pretty big compliment. Lucy didn't buy it. In fact, she didn't even let me explain at all, said instead, "Oh, shut up, Desmond, just shut up." And off we went to work, silent, stewing, our hurt feelings like a sack of broken toys between us. Now she's not speaking to me. It's going to be a long day. The buzzer sounds and I move into the next box. I do my duty with the broom, and when the buzzer sounds again, I replace the catcher. The cat here is a howling orange monster, and I have my hands full. When the animal is this fresh, the tossing technique looks a lot like volleyball. You don't want to be too close to the thing for very long. By the time Lucy takes her place across from me, I've established a rhythm, and am even able to put a little spin on the cat now and then. I have to hand it to Lucy. She catches up quickly, and soon we have the animals sailing smoothly between us. The animals go through stages as we toss and catch them. First, defiance, then resistance, followed by resignation, then despair, and finally death. This one is probably somewhere in the resistance stage, not fighting wildly, but watching for an opening to do some damage. I put one hand on the cat's chest and the other under its bottom and send it across to Lucy in a sitting position. Not to be outdone, she sends it back, still sitting but upside down now. Maybe the silly positions have done the trick. Whatever. I can feel the animal slip into the resignation stage. I toss the cat tumbling head over heels, a weak howl, and a loose string of saliva trailing behind it. Is Lucy ever going to talk to me again? Okay, I'm sorry, I say, giving in to the idea that I might never know exactly why I should be sorry. I see tears come to her eyes, and she falters, nearly drops the cat. I want to go to her. I want to comfort her. But it will be some time before we're both on a break at the same time. And I see suddenly that it will be too late by then. It simply won't matter anymore. My replacement comes in and sweeps up. Then the buzzer sounds. I step aside. Lucy isn't crying anymore. I reach for the door.
The Manticore Spell. Jeffrey Ford.
Jeffrey Ford is the author of the novels The Physiognomy, Memoranda, The Beyond, The Portrait of Mrs. Charbuke, The Girl in the Glass, and The Shadow Year. His short fiction has been published in 3 collections, The Fantasy Writer's Assistant, The Empire of Ice Cream, and The Drowned Life. His fiction has won the World Fantasy Award, the Nebula Award, the Edgar Allan Poe Award, and Grand Prix d'Imaginaire. He lives in New Jersey with his wife and 2 sons and teaches literature and writing at Brookdale Community College. Ford has said that his use of the manticore as the center of a story was influenced by his having read a number of old and modern bestiaries, and by the pre-Raphaelite paintings of fantastic creatures, harpies, unicorns, mermaids, and the Sphinx. In addition, his fellow teacher and author, William John Watkins, a sort of wizard in his own right, had just retired. Watkins taught Ford so much about writing and teaching, 2 strange, chimerical beasts, that he was given a place in the story as well.
The first reports of the creature, mere sightings, were absurd. A confusion of parts, a loss of words to describe the smile. The color, they said, was a flame, a hot coal, a flower, and each of the witnesses tried to mimic the thing's song, but none could. My master, the wizard Watkin, bade me record in word and image everything each one said. We'd been put to it by the king, whose comment was,
"Give an ear to their drollery. Make them think you're thinking about it at my command. It's naught but bad air, my old friend."
My master nodded and smiled. But after the king had left the room, the wizard turned to me and whispered,
"Manticore."
"It's the last one, no doubt," said Watkin. We watched from the balcony in late afternoon, when the king's hunters returned from the forest across the wide green lawn to the palace, the blood of the manticore's victims trailing bright red through the grass.
"It's a very old one," he said. "You can tell by the fact that it devours the horses, but the humans often return with a limb or two intact."
He cast a spell of protection around the monster, threading the eye of a needle with a hummingbird feather.
"You want it to survive?" I asked.
"To live till it dies naturally," was his answer. "The king's hunters must not kill it."
Beneath the moon and stars at the edge of autumn, we sat with the rest of the court along the ramparts of the castle and listened for the creature's flute-like trill, descending and ascending the scale, moving through the distant darkness of the trees. Its sound set the crystal goblets to vibrating. The ladies played hearts by candlelight, their hair up and powdered. The gentlemen leaned back, smoking their pipes, discussing how they'd fell the beast if the job was theirs.
"Wizard," the king said, "I thought you'd taken measures."
"I did," said Watkin. "It's difficult, though. Magic against magic, and I'm an old man."
A few moments later, the king's engineer appeared at his side. The man carried a mechanical weapon that shot an arrow made of elephant ivory.
"The tip is dipped in acid that will eat the creature's flesh," said the engineer. "Aim anywhere above the neck. Keep the gearwork within the gun well oiled."
His Highness smiled and nodded. A week later, just prior to dinner, at the daily ritual in which the king assessed the state of his kingdom, it was reported that the creature devoured two horses and a hunter, took the right leg of the engineer's assistant, and so twisted and crumpled the new weapon of the engineer that the poison arrow set to strike the beast turned around and stabbed its inventor in the ear, the lobe of which dripped off his head like a lit candle.
"We fear the thing may lay eggs," said the engineer. "I suggest we burn the forest."
"We're not burning down the forest," said the king.
He turned and looked at the wizard. Watkin faked sleep. I helped the old man out of his chair and accompanied him down the stone steps to the corridor that led to our chambers. Before I let him go, he took me by the collar and whispered,
"The spell's weakening. I can feel it in my gums."
I nodded, and he brushed me aside, walking the rest of the way to his rooms unassisted. Following behind, I looked over my shoulder, almost positive the king was aware that his wizard's art had been turned against him. I lay down in my small space off the western side of the workroom. I could see the inverted, hairless pink corpse of the hunch monkey swinging from the ceiling in the other room. The wizard had ridden away for it to Palgeria 5 years earlier, or so said his records. When it arrived, I could see by his reaction that he could no longer remember what he'd meant to do with it. 2 days later, he came to me and said,
"See what you can make of this hunch monkey."
I had no idea, so I hung the carcass in the workroom. From the first day of my service to Watkin, he insisted that I tell him my dreams each morning.
"Dreams are the manner in which those who mean you harm infiltrate the defenses of your existence," he told me during a thunderstorm.
It was mid-August, and we stood dry beneath the spreading branches of a hemlock one afternoon as a hard rain fell in curtains around us. That night, in sleep, I followed a woman through a field of purple flowers that eventually sloped down to the edge of a cliff. Below, an enormous mound of black rock heaved as if breathing, and when it expanded, I could see through cracks and fissures red and orange light radiating out from within. The dream woman looked over her shoulder and said,
"Do you remember the day you came to serve the wizard?"
Then the light was in my eyes, and I was surprised to find I was awake. Watkin, holding a lantern up to my face, said,
"It's perished. Come quickly."
He spun away from the bed, casting me in shadow again. I trembled as I dressed. I'd seen the old man pull with his teeth the spirit of a spitting demon from the nostril of one of the ladies of court. Unfathomable. His flowered robe was a brilliant design of peonies in the snow. But I no longer trusted the sun. I stepped into the workroom as Watkin was clearing things from the huge table at which he mixed his powders and dissected the reptiles whose small brains had a region that when mashed and dried quickened his potions.
"Fetch your pen and paper," he said. "We will record everything."
I did as I was told and then helped him. At one point he tried to lift a large crystal globe of blue powder and his thin wrists shook with the exertion. I took it from him, just as it slipped from his fingers. Suddenly, everywhere, the scent of roses and cinnamon. The wizard sniffed the air, and warned me that its arrival was imminent. 6 hunters carried the corpse, draped across 3 battle stretchers, and covered by the frayed tapestry of the War of the Willows, which had hung in the corridor that ran directly from the treasury to the pity fountain. Watkin and I stood back, as the dark, bearded men grunted, gritted their teeth, and hoisted the stretchers onto the table. As they filed out of our chambers, my master handed each of them a small packet of powder tied up with a ribbon, an aphrodisiac, I suspected. Before collecting his reward and leaving, the last of the hunters took the edge of the tapestry, and lifting the corner high, walked swiftly around the table, unveiling the manticore. I glanced for a mere sliver and instinctually looked away. While my eyes were averted, I heard the old man purr, squeal, chitter. The thick cloud of the creature's scent was a weight on my shoulders, and then I noticed the first buzz of the flies. The wizard slapped my face and forced me to look. His grip on the back of my neck could not be denied. It was crimson and shades of crimson, and after I noted the color, I saw the teeth and looked at nothing else for a time, both a wince and a smile. I saw the lion paws, the fur, the breasts, that long, beautiful hair. The tail of shining segments led to a smooth, sharp stinger, a green bubble of venom at its tip.
"Write this down," said Watkin.
I fumbled for my pen.
"Female manticore," he said.
I wrote at the top of the page. The wizard took one step that seemed to last for minutes. Then he took another and another, until he was pacing slowly around the table, studying the creature from all sides. In his right hand, he held the cane with the wizard's head carved into the head of it. Its tip was not touching the floor.
"Draw it," he commanded.
I set to the task, but this was a skill I was deficient at. Still, I drew it, the human head and torso, the powerful body of a lion, the tail of the scorpion. It turned out to be my best drawing, but it too was terrible.
"The first time I saw one of these," Watkin said, "I was with my class as a boy. We'd gone on a walk to the lake, and we'd just passed through an orchard and onto a large meadow with yellow flowers. My teacher, a woman named Levu, with a mole beside her lip, pointed into the distance, one hand on my shoulder, and whispered, 'A husband and wife, manticore, look.' I saw them. Blurs of crimson, grazing the low-hanging fruit by the edge of the meadow. On our way back to town that evening, we heard their distinctive trill and then were attacked by 2 of them. They each had 3 rows of teeth, chewing perfectly in sync. I watched them devour the teacher as she frantically confessed to me. While I prayed for her, the monsters recited poems in an exotic tongue, and licked the blood from their lips."
I wrote down all of what Watkin said, although I wasn't sure it was to the point. He never looked me in the eye, but moved slowly, slowly around the thing, lightly prodding it with his cane, squinting with one eye into the darkness of its recesses.
"Do you see the face?" he asked me.
I told him I did.
"But for that fiendish smile, she's beautiful," he said.
I tried to see her without the smile, and what I saw in my mind was the smile without her. Suffice to say, her skin was crimson as was her fur, her eyes yellow diamonds. Her long hair had its own mind, deep red-violet whips at her command. and then that smile.
"She lived next to me with hair as long as this, but golden," Watkins said, pointing. "I a little younger than you, she a little older. Only once we went out together into the desert and climbed down into the dunes. Underground there, in the ruins, we saw the stone-carved face of the hunch monkey. We lay down in front of it together, kissed, and went to sleep. Our parents and neighbors were looking for us. Late in the night, while she slept, a wind blew through the pursed lips of the stone face, warning me of treachery and time. When she woke, she said in sleep she'd visited the ocean and gone fishing with a manticore. The next time we kissed was at our wedding."
"Draw that," he shouted. I did my best, but didn't know whether to depict the manticore or the wizard with her at the beach.
"One more thing about the smile," he said. "It continually, perpetually grinds with the organic rotary mechanism of a well-lubricated jaw and three sets of teeth. Even after death, in the grave, it masticates the pitch black."
"Should I draw that?" I asked. He'd begun walking. A few moments later, he said,
"No."
He laid down his cane on the edge of the table and took one of the paws in both his hands.
"Look here at this claw," he said. "How many heads do you think it's taken off?"
10, I said.
10,000, he said,
dropping the paw and retrieving his cane.
"How many will it take off now?" he asked.
I didn't answer.
"The lion is fur, muscle, tendon, claw, and speed. Five important ingredients of the unfathomable. Once a king of Drisha captured and tamed a brood of manticore. He led them into battles on long thousand-link iron chains. They cut through the forward ranks of the charging Ingridots with the artful tenacity His Royal Highness reserves for only the largest pastries."
"Take this down?" I asked.
"To the last dribbling vowel,"
he said, nodding and slowly moving. His cane finally tapped the floor.
"Supposedly," he said, "there's another smaller organ floating within their single-chambered heart. At the center of this small organ is a smaller ball of gold, the purest gold imaginable. So pure it could be eaten. And if it were, I am told the result is 1,000,000 beautiful dreams of flying." "I had an uncle," said the wizard, "who hunted the creature, bagged one, cut out its ball of gold, and proceeded to eat the entire thing in one bound. After that, my uncle was sane only 5 times a day. Always he had his hands up. His tongue was always wagging, his eyes shivering. He walked away from home one night when no one was watching. He wandered into the forest. There were reports for a while of a ragged holy man, but then a visitor returned his ring and watch and told us his head had been found. Once it was safely under glass, I performed my first magic on it and had it tell me about its final appointment with a manticore. 'Take a lock of this hair, boy, when we're done,' he said. 'When you get old, tie it into a knot and wear it in your vest pocket. It will ward off danger, to an extent.'
'How fast do they run?' I asked.
'How fast?' he said,
and then he stopped walking. A breeze blew through the windows and porticos of the workroom. He turned quickly and looked over his shoulder out the window. Storm clouds, lush hedge, and a humidity of roses and cinnamon. The flies now swarmed.
'That fast,' he said. 'Draw it.' 'Notice,' he said, 'there is no wound. The hunters didn't kill it. It died of old age and they found it.'"
He stood very silent, his hands behind his back. I wondered if he'd run out of things to say. Then he cleared his throat and said,
"There's a point at which a wince and a smile share the same shape and intensity. Almost, but not quite, the same meaning. It's at that point, and that point alone, that you can begin to understand the beast's scorpion tail. Sleek, black, poisonous, and needle-sharp, it moves like lightning, piercing flesh and bone, depositing a chemical that halts all memory. When stung, you want to scream, to run, to aim your crossbow at its magenta heart, but alas, you forget.
I'm drawing it,
I said. Excellent, he said, and ran his free hand over one of the smooth sections of the scorpion tail. Don't forget to capture the forgetting, he laughed to himself. The manticore venom was at one time used to cure certain cases of melancholia. There's very often some incident from the past at the heart of depression. The green poison measured judiciously and administered with a long syringe to the corner of the eye will instantly paralyze memory, negating the cause of sorrow. There was one fellow I'd heard who took too much of it and forgot to forget. He remembered everything and could let nothing go. His head filled up with every second of every day, and it finally exploded. The poison doesn't kill you, though. It only dazes you with the inability to remember. So those teeth can have their way. There are those few who'd been stung by the beast but not devoured. In every case, they described experiencing the same illusion. An eye-blink journey to an old summer home with four floors of guest rooms, sunset, mosquitoes. For the duration of the poison's strength, around 2 days, the victim lives at this retreat, in the mind, of course. There are cool breezes as the dark comes on, moths against the screen, the sound of waves far off, and the victim comes to the conclusion that he or she is alone. I suppose to die while in the throes of the poison is to stay alone at that beautiful place by the sea for eternity. I spoke without thinking. Every aspect of the beast brings you to eternity. The smile, the purest gold, the sting.
Write that down, said Watkin.
What else can you say of it? I remember that day I came to serve you, I said, and on the long stretch through the poplars. My carriage was stopped due to a dead body in the road. As the carriage passed, I peered out to see a bloody mess on the ground. You were one of the people in the crowd.
You can't understand my invisible connection to these creatures. A certain symbiosis. I feel it in my lower back. Magic becomes a pinhole shrinking into the future, he said.
Can you bring the monster back to life? I asked him.
No, he said. It doesn't work that way. I have something else in mind.
He stepped over to a workbench, left the cane there, and lifted a hatchet. Returning to the body of the creature, he walked slowly around it to the tail.
That was my wife you saw in the road that day, killed by a manticore. By this very manticore.
I'm sorry, I said. I'd think you'd have tried harder to kill it.
Don't try to understand, he said.
He lifted the hatchet high above his head, and then, with one swift chop, severed the stinger from the tail of the creature.
Under the spell of the poison, I will go to the summer house and rescue her from eternity.
I'll go with you, I said.
You can't go. You could be stranded in eternity with my wife and me. Think of that, said Watkin. No. There's something else I need you to do for me while I'm under the effects of the venom. You must take the head of the manticore into the forest and bury it. Their heads turn into the roots of trees, the fruit of which are manticore pups. You'll carry the last seed.
He used the hatchet to sever the creature's head while I dressed for the outdoors. I'd learned to ride a horse before I went to serve the wizard. But the forest at night frightened me. I couldn't shake the image of Watkin's palm impaled on the tip of the black stinger, and him, rapidly accruing dullness, gagging, his eyes rolling back behind their lids. I carried the manticore head in a woolen sack, tied to the saddle, and trembled at the prospect that perhaps Watkin was wrong, and the one sprawled on the work table, headless and tailless, was not the last.
For my protection, he'd given me a spell to use if it became necessary. A fistful of yellow powder, and a half-dozen words I no longer remembered. I rode through the dark for a few minutes and had quickly had enough of it. I dismounted and dug a hole at the side of the path, standing my torch upright in it. It made a broad circle of light on the ground. I retrieved the shovel I'd brought and the head. After nearly an hour of digging, I began to hear a slight murmuring sound coming from somewhere close by me. I thought someone was spying from a darker part of the forest, and then I took it for the whirring of a manticore's tri-toothed jaws, and was paralyzed by fear. 2 minutes later, I realized the voice was coming from inside the sack. When I looked, the smile was facing out. The manticore's eyes went wide, that chasm of a mouth opened, flashing three-way ivory, and she spoke in a foreign language. I took her out of the sack, set her head up at the center of the circle of torchlight, brushed back her hair, and listened to the beautiful sing-song language. Later, after waking from a kind of trance brought on by the flow of words, I remembered the spell Watkin had given me. Laying the powder out on the upturned palm of my hand, I aimed it carefully and blew it into the creature's face. She coughed. I'd forgotten the words, so said anything that I recalled them sounding like. Then she spoke to me, and I understood her.
"Eternity," she said,
and then repeated it, methodically, with the precise same intonation again and again and again. I grabbed the shovel and started digging. By the time I had dug a deep enough hole, my nerves were frayed by her repetition, and I couldn't fill the dirt in fast enough. When the head was thoroughly buried, its endless phrase still sounding muffled beneath the ground, I tamped the soil down and then found an odd-looking green rock, like a fist, to mark the spot for future reference. Watkin never returned from the place by the sea. After the venom wore off, his body was lifeless. I then became the wizard.
No one seemed to care that I knew nothing about magic. "Make it up till you've got it," said the king. "Then spread it around."
I thanked him for his insight, but was aware he'd eaten pure gold and now, when not soaring in his dreams, was rarely sane. The years came and went, and I did my best to learn the devices, potions, phenomena, that Watkin had bothered to record. I suppose there was something of magic in it, but it wasn't readily recognizable. I was able to witness Watkin's fate by use of a magic looking glass I'd found in his bedroom, and learned to command. It was a tall mirror that stood on the back of his writing desk. In it, I could see anywhere in existence with a simple command. I chose the quiet place by the sea, and there before me were the clean-swept pathways, the blossoming wisteria, the gray and splintering fence board. Darkness was coming on. The woman with golden hair sat on the screened porch in a wicker rocker, listening to the floorboards creak. The twilight breeze was cool against sunburn. The day seemed endless. As night came on, she rocked herself to sleep. I ordered the mirror to show me her dream. She dreamed that she was at the beach. The surf rolled gently up across the sand. There was a manticore, her crimson resplendent against the clear blue day, fishing at the shoreline with a weighted net. Without fear, the woman with bright hair approached the creature. The manticore politely asked, with smile upon smile, if the woman would like to help hoist the net. She nodded. The net was flung far out and they waited. Finally, there was a tug. The woman with the golden hair and the manticore both pulled hard to retrieve their catch. Eventually, they dragged Watkin ashore, tangled in the webbing, seaweed in his hair. She ran to him and helped him out of the net. They put their arms around each other and kissed. Now I keep my ears pricked up for descriptions of strange beasts in the heart of the forest. If a horse or a human goes missing, I must get to the bottom of it before I can rest. I try to speak to the hunters every day. Reports of the creature are vague but growing, and I realize now I have some invisible connection to it, as if its muffled, muted voice is enclosed within a chamber of my heart, relentlessly whispering, "Eternity."
Catskin, Kelly Link. Kelly Link is the author of three collections, Stranger Things Happen, Magic for Beginners, and Pretty Monsters, the last for young adults. Her short stories have recently been published in Tin House, Firebirds Rising, Noisy Outlaws, The Restless Dead, The Starry Rift, and Troll's Eye View. Her work has won 3 Nebulas, a Hugo, 4 Locus Awards, the British Science Fiction Association Award, and a World Fantasy Award. She and her husband, Gavin J. Grant, run Small Beer Press, and twice yearly produce the zine Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet. Link has said that the inspiration for Catskin was a conversation she had with fellow writer Christopher Rowe about whether or not a picture of his cat was a real feline or a spooky cat impersonator. Rowe produced a zine, Say, Is This a Cat?, on the subject.
Cats went in and out of the witch's house all day long. The windows stayed open, and the doors, and there were other doors, cat-sized and private, in the walls and up in the attic. The cats were large and sleek and silent. No one ever knew their names, or even if they had names, except for the witch. Some of the cats were cream-colored, and some were brindled. Some were black as beetles. They were about the witch's business. Some came into the witch's bedroom with live things in their mouths. When they came out again, their mouths were empty. The cats trotted and slunk and leapt and crouched. They were busy. Their movements were cat-like, or perhaps clockwork. Their tails twitched like hairy pendulums. They paid no attention to the witch's children. The witch had 3 living children at this time, although at one time she had had dozens, maybe more. No one, certainly not the witch, had ever bothered to tally them up. But at one time the house had bulged with cats and babies. Now, since witches cannot have children in the usual way, their wombs are full of straw or bricks or stones, and when they give birth to rabbits, kittens, tadpoles, houses, silk dresses. And yet, even witches must have heirs. Even witches wish to be mothers. The witch had acquired her children by other means. She had stolen or bought them. She'd had a passion for children with a certain color of red hair. Twins she had never been able to abide. They were the wrong kind of magic. Although she'd sometimes attempted to match up sets of children, as though she had been putting together a chess set and not a family. If you were to say a witch's chess set instead of a witch's family, there would be some truth in that. Perhaps this is true of other families as well. One girl, she had grown like a cyst upon her thigh. Other children she had made out of things in her garden, or bits of trash that the cats brought her. Aluminum foil with strings of chicken fat still crusted to it, broken television sets, cardboard boxes that the neighbors had thrown out. She had always been a thrifty witch. Some of these children had run away, and others had died. Some of them she had simply misplaced or accidentally left behind on buses. It is to be hoped that these children were later adopted into good homes or reunited with their natural parents. If you are looking for a happy ending in this story, then perhaps you should stop reading here and picture these children, these parents, their reunions. Are you still reading? The witch, up in her bedroom, was dying. She had been poisoned by an enemy, a witch, a man named Lack. The child Fen, who had been her food taster, was dead already, and so were 3 cats who'd licked her dish clean. The witch knew who had killed her, and she snatched pieces of time here and there from the business of dying to make her revenge. Once the question of this revenge had been settled to her satisfaction, the shape of it, like a black ball of twine in her head, she began to divide up her estate between her three remaining children. Flecks of vomit stuck to the corners of her mouth, and there was a basin beside the foot of the bed, which was full of black liquid. The room smelled like cat's piss and wet matches. The witch panted as if she were giving birth to her own death.
"Flora shall have my automobile," she said, "and also my purse, which will never be empty. So long as you always leave a coin at the bottom, my darling, my spendthrift, my profligate, my drop of poison, my pretty, pretty Flora. And when I am dead, take the road outside the house and go west. There's one last piece of advice."
Flora, who was the oldest of the witch's living children, was red-headed and stylish. She had been waiting for the witch's death for a long time now, although she had been patient. She kissed the witch's cheek and said,
"Thank you, Mother."
The witch looked up at her, panting. She could see Flora's life already laid out, flat as a map. Perhaps all mothers can see as far.
"Jack, my love, my bird's nest, my bite, my scrap of porridge," the witch said. "You shall have my books. I won't have any need of books where I'm going. And when you leave my house, strike out in an easterly direction, and you won't be any sorrier than you are now."
Jack, who had once been a little bundle of feathers and twigs, an eggshell all tied up with a tatty piece of string, was a sturdy lad, almost full grown. If he knew how to read, only the cats knew it. But he nodded and kissed his mother's gray lips.
"And what shall I leave to my boy, Small?" the witch said, convulsing.
She threw up again in the basin. Cats came running, leaning on the lip of the basin to inspect her vomitus. The witch's hand dug into Small's leg.
"Oh, it is hard, hard, so very hard for a mother to leave her children, though I have done harder things. Children need a mother, even such a mother as I have been."
She wiped at her eyes, and yet it is a fact that witches cannot cry. Small, who still slept in the witch's bed, was the youngest of the witch's children, perhaps not as young as you think. He sat upon the bed, and although he didn't cry, it was only because witches' children have no one to teach them the use of crying. His heart was breaking. Small could juggle and sing, and every morning he brushed and plaited the witch's long, silky hair. Surely every mother must wish for a boy like Small, a curly-headed, sweet-breathed, tender-hearted boy like Small, who can cook a fine omelet, and who has a good, strong singing voice, as well as a gentle hand with a hairbrush.
"Mother," he said, "if you must die, then you must die. And if I can't come along with you, then I'll do my best to live and make you proud. Give me your hairbrush to remember you by, and I'll go make my own way in the world."
"You shall have my hairbrush, then," said the witch to Small, looking and panting, panting. "And I love you best of all. You shall have my tinderbox and my matches, and also my revenge. And you will make me proud, or I don't know my own children.
What shall we do with the house, Mother? Said Jack. He said it as if he didn't care.
When I am dead, the witch said, this house will be of no use to anyone. I gave birth to it. That was a very long time ago. And raised it from just a dollhouse. Oh, it was the most dear, most darling dollhouse ever. It had 8 rooms and a tin roof and a staircase that went nowhere at all. But I nursed it and rocked it to sleep in a cradle, and it grew up to be a real house. And see how it has taken care of me, its parent, how it knows a child's duty to its mother. And perhaps you can see how it is now, how it pines, how it grows sick to see me dying like this. Leave it to the cats. They'll know what to do with it.
All this time, the cats have been running in and out of the room, bringing things and taking things away. It seems as if they will never slow down, never come to rest, never nap, never have the time to sleep, or to die, or even to mourn. They have a certain proprietary look about them, as if the house is already theirs. The witch vomits up mud, fur, glass buttons, tin soldiers, trowels, hat pins, thumbtacks, love letters mislabeled or sent without the appropriate amount of postage and never read, and a dozen regiments of red ants, each ant as long and wide as a kidney bean. The ants swim across the perilous, stinking basin, clamber up the sides of the basin, and go marching across the floor in a shiny ribbon. They are carrying pieces of time in their mandibles. Time is heavy, even in such small pieces, but the ants have strong jaws, strong legs. Across the floor they go, and up the wall, and out the window. The cats watch, but don't interfere. The witch gasps and coughs and then lies still. Her hands beat against the bed once and then are still. Still, the children wait to make sure that she is dead and that she has nothing else to say. In the witch's house, the dead are sometimes quite talkative. But the witch has nothing else to say at this time. The house groans, and all the cats begin to mew piteously, trotting in and out of the room as if they have dropped something and must go and hunt for it. They will never find it. And the children, at last, find they know how to cry. But the witch is perfectly still and quiet. There is a tiny smile on her face, as if everything has happened exactly to her satisfaction. Or, maybe, she is looking forward to the next part of the story. The children buried the witch in one of her half-grown dollhouses. They crammed her into the downstairs parlor and knocked out the inner walls so that her head rested on the kitchen table in the breakfast nook, and her ankles threaded through a bedroom door. Small brushed out her hair, and, because he wasn't sure what she should wear now that she was dead, he put all her dresses on her, one over the other, until he could hardly see her white limbs at all beneath the stack of petticoats and coats and dresses. It didn't matter. Once they'd nailed the dollhouse shut again, all they could see was the red crown of her head in the kitchen window. and the worn-down heels of her dancing shoes knocking against the shutters of the bedroom window. Jack, who was handy, rigged a set of wheels for the dollhouse and a harness so that it could be pulled. They put the harness on Small, and Small pulled and Flora pushed, and Jack talked and coaxed the house along, over the hill, down to the cemetery, and the cats ran along beside them. The cats are beginning to look a bit shabby, as if they are molting. Their mouths look very empty. The ants have marched away through the woods and down into town, and they have built a nest on your yard, out of the bits of time. And if you hold a magnifying glass over their nest to see the ants dance and burn, time will catch fire, and you will be sorry. Outside the cemetery gates, the cats had been digging a grave for the witch. The children tipped the dollhouse into the grave, kitchen window first, but then they saw that the grave wasn't deep enough, and the house sat there on its end, looking uncomfortable. Small began to cry. Now that he'd learned how, it seemed he would spend all his time practicing. Thinking how horrible it would be to spend one's death, all of eternity, upside down, and not even properly buried. Not even able to feel the rain when it beat down on the exposed shingles of the house, and seeped down into the house, and filled your mouth and drowned you, so that you had to die all over again every time it rained. The dollhouse chimney had broken off and fallen on the ground. One of the cats picked it up and carried it away like a souvenir. That cat carried the chimney into the woods and ate it, a mouthful at a time, and passed out of this story and into another one. It's no concern of ours. The other cats began to carry up mouthfuls of dirt, dropping it and mounding it around the house with their paws. The children helped, and when they'd finished, they'd managed to bury the witch properly, so that only the bedroom window was visible. A little pane of glass like an eye at the top of a small dirt hill. On the way home, Flora began to flirt with Jack. Perhaps she liked the way he looked in his funeral black. They talked about what they planned to be, now that they were grown up. Flora wanted to find her parents. She was a pretty girl. Someone would want to look after her. Jack said he would like to marry someone rich. They began to make plans. Small walked a little behind, slippery cats twining around his ankles. He had the witch's hairbrush in his pocket, and his fingers slipped around the figured horn handle for comfort. The house, when they reached it, had a dangerous, grief-stricken look to it, as if it was beginning to pull away from itself. Flora and Jack wouldn't go back inside. They squeezed Small lovingly and asked if he wouldn't want to come along with them. He would have liked to, but who would have looked after the witch's cats, the witch's revenge? So he watched as they drove off together. They went north. What child has ever heeded a mother's advice? Jack hasn't even bothered to bring along the witch's library. He says there isn't space in the trunk for everything. He'll rely on Flora and her magic purse. Small sat in the garden and ate stalks of grass when he was hungry, and pretended that the grass was bread and milk and chocolate cake. He drank out of the garden hose. When it began to grow dark, he was lonelier than he had ever been in his life. The witch's cats were not good company. He said nothing to them, and they had nothing to tell him about the house, or the future, or the witch's revenge, or about where he was supposed to sleep. He had never slept anywhere except in the witch's bed. So at last he went back over the hill and down to the cemetery. Some of the cats were still going up and down the grave, covering the base of the mound with leaves and grass and feathers, their own loose fur. It was a soft sort of nest to lie down on. The cats were still busy when Small fell asleep. Cats are always busy. Cheek pressed against the cool glass of the bedroom window, hand curled in his pocket around the hairbrush, but in the middle of the night, when he woke up, he was swaddled, head to foot, in warm, grass-scented cat bodies. A tail is curled around his chin like a rope, and all the bodies are soughing breath in and out, whiskers and paws twitching, silky bellies rising and falling. All the cats are sleeping a frantic, exhausted, busy sleep, except for one, a white cat who sits near his head, looking down at him. Small has never seen this cat before, and yet he knows her, the way that you know the people who visit you in dreams. She's white everywhere, except for reddish tufts and frills at her ears and tail and paws, as if someone has embroidered her with fire around the edges. "What's your name?" Small says. He's never talked to the witch's cats before. The cat lifts a leg and licks herself in a private place. Then she looks at him. "You may call me Mother," she says. But Small shakes his head. He can't call the cat that. Down under the blanket of cats under the window pane, the witch's Spanish heel is drinking in moonlight. "Very well, then. You may call me the Witch's Revenge," the cat says. Her mouth doesn't move, but he hears her speak inside his head. Her voice is furry and sharp, like a blanket made of needles. "And you may comb my fur." Small sits up, displacing sleeping cats, and lifts the brush out of his pocket. The bristles have left rows of little holes indented in the pink palm of his hand, like some sort of code. If he could read the code, it would say, "Comb my fur." Small combs the fur of the witch's revenge. There's grave dirt in the cat's fur, and one or two red ants who drop and scurry away. The witch's revenge bends her head down to the ground, snaps them up in her jaws. The heap of cats around them is yawning and stretching. There are things to do. "You must burn her house down," the witch's revenge says. "That's the first thing." Small's comb catches a knot, and the witch's revenge turns and nips him on the wrist. Then she licks him in the tender place between his thumb and his first finger. "That's enough," she says. "There's work to do." So they all go back to the house, Small stumbling in the dark, moving farther and farther away from the witch's grave. The cats trotting along, their eyes lit like torches, twigs and branches in their mouths, as if they planned to build a nest, a canoe, a fence to keep the world out. The house, when they reach it, is full of lights and more cats and piles of tinder. The house is making a noise, like an instrument that someone is breathing into. Small realizes that all the cats are mewing endlessly as they run in and out the doors looking for more kindling. The witch's revenge says, "First, we must latch all the doors." So Small shuts all the doors and windows on the first floor, leaving open only the kitchen door. And the witch's revenge shuts the catches on the secret doors, the cat doors, the doors in the attic, and up on the roof, and the cellar doors. Not a single secret door is left open. Now, all the noise is on the inside, and Small and the witch's revenge are on the outside. All the cats have slipped into the house through the kitchen door. There isn't a single cat in the garden. Small can see the witch's cats through the windows, arranging their piles of twigs. The witch's revenge sits beside him, watching. Now, light a match and throw it in, says the witch's revenge. Small lights a match. He throws it in. What boy doesn't love to start a fire? Now shut the kitchen door, says the witch's revenge. But Small can't do that. All the cats are inside. The witch's revenge stands on her hind paws and pushes the kitchen door shut. Inside, the lit match catches something on fire. Fire runs along the floor and up the kitchen walls. Cats catch fire and run into the other rooms of the house. Small can see all this through the windows. He stands with his face against the glass, which is cold, and then warm, and then hot. Burning cats with burning twigs in their mouths press up against the kitchen door and the other doors of the house, but all the doors are locked. Small and the witch's revenge